Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent to kick off season 5 of MASHcast is Brigadier General Dan Greenfield. Hi, Dan.
Brigadier General. Wow. I finally made it to the top.
I think there's a couple more. I think I could do General Command of the Soul Sector. So I have to go through and find some of these words.
But Brigadier General, I'll take that. I thought he was going to be, corporal this time.
No. We're all forever up. Forever. By season 11, you'll be President of the United States. So, Dan, you opened up season 4 with me last year, and you were nice enough to come by to open up season 5. So thank you so much for coming back. We're talking about another hour-long season opener for MASH.
Yes, and thank you for having me. This is it's always an honor to be on this show, and I love talking about MASH whenever possible, and this is a good one, so I'm happy to get to discuss it.
Absolutely, this is a really fun show. It's season 5, episode 1, Bug Out. The original air date was September 21st, 1976, written by the always dynamite team of Fritz L. and Greenbaum, and directed by Gene Reynolds. So a rumor starts flying around that due to an upcoming enemy attack, the 477th is bugging out. Colonel Potter tries to stamp out all these rumors, but it doesn't seem to help. When a patient with spinal cord damage arrives, Hawkeye is initially reluctant to operate because, once he's been worked on, the patient can't be moved for 24 hours. But Potter insists that they aren't bugging out, so Hawkeye, with Margaret and BJ assisting, go ahead. But of course, as soon as they start, the 477th gets word from HQ that they are, in fact, bugging out. This sends everyone into a frenzy. Colonel Potter puts Frank in charge. He has no choice, since Burns is second in command, while Potter scouts locations for the new unit. Hawkeye says he's staying behind to look after the patient, and Margaret volunteers to stay as well. And then, at the last moment, as everyone is riding out of camp, Radar stays behind too. Colonel Potter, BJ, and Frank lead the caravan to the new location for the 477th and walk up to what looks like an abandoned hut, except that it's not abandoned. It's full of business girls. Frank wants to evict them by force, but Potter wants to try and bargain with them. No matter what he offers, they refuse to turn over the building. That is, until they see Klinger's array of clothes, which they moon over. Potter asks Klinger to give up the Klinger collection as an act of patriotism. Klinger reluctantly agrees. Meanwhile, back at the 477th, the spinal cord patient seems to be recovering well enough to be flown out by chopper. After the patient is sent off, a battalion of troops arrive. When asked by Hawkeye where the front is, the soldier replies, "You're standing on it." The troops drive on, leaving Hawkeye, Margaret, and Radar in the eerily quiet 477th compound. They climb in a jeep to catch up with the rest of the unit, but the jeep won't start. When they hear a loud clamor of people coming up the road, they assume it's the Chinese and try to hide, a little hard since all that's left of the tents are the framework. They start to panic as the noise gets louder, but are relieved to see that it's the rest of the 477th led by Colonel Potter. He tells them that the U.S. retook the same piece of land, so they have been ordered to return home. Relieved, Margaret climbs aboard Sophie, her arms around Colonel Potter as he manages the traffic. Everyone, for the moment, is happy. All right, so Dan, I want to ask you what you think about this hour-long show, because I think that the old saw about sitcoms when they do hour-long shows is that they're too long. Like there's padding. Sitcoms never quite work at an hour length. Now, I think obviously last year when we talked about Welcome to Korea, that is a stellar episode. I mean, yes. I think by anybody's estimation, Welcome to Korea is one of their best shows. This episode, obviously, the stakes are a lot lower. We're not introducing a new character or anything like that. But what do you think of this show as an hour-long story?
Oh, I think it works. And I think it works for... I think there's the one thing that I found a little odd in rewatching it, which, of course, I've seen this episode a million times, but I watched it again last night just to obviously get refreshed and be up to speed on all the details. But the only thing that I found awkward about it was the post-syndication split.
Yes.
The weird way the episode is divided. And then I noticed by watching it on Hulu that the second half is actually 4 minutes longer than the first half. And I'm not sure why. Maybe it was a commercials thing. Maybe it was a whatever. However they decided to break it up, it's a weird place for it to happen. So it doesn't have the same kind of drama or the same kind of pacing that last year's season-long episode had. But in watching it all together, it really does hold together. And I think for a couple of reasons is that it has, just like in a different way, it has what Welcome to Korea also had, is that it has a cinematic quality to it. It's an episode that feels bigger because you get to see things that you've never seen before, which is them bugging out like this in a way that you actually see them taking everything down. You appreciate the for what MASH is, the military precision with which they actually get it done. And it's something we're not used to seeing. And I appreciate that. I also appreciate the fact that it's still MASH at its best when it's a character study. And a study not just of the characters, but the characters' relationships. And this is really, in a way, the last gasp of the old Margaret Houlihan. And she's really, because I've long felt that seasons 5 and 6 in particular are the whole subtext is the reclamation of Margaret Houlihan as a character, where they really decided that they were going to they'd already begun, but in this episode and episodes that follow, obviously, because she gets engaged, is the Margaret that we all come to know and love, as opposed to the one-note joke. She starts out in the episode as a one-note joke, and at the end, you see that bond between her and her colleagues, and that bond of respect that I think the hour-long show actually really helps. Plus, I also think, you don't necessarily think of it this way, but it's a Harry Morgan tour de force, too. He's tremendous in this episode. He really is. I mean, I must have laughed out loud a dozen times at his either reactions to things or his comments. And you forget that about that because he's such a solid part of the cast that you take him for granted. And watching him last night, I was like, geez, wow, he's just fantastic in this role. So I know that's a long-winded way of answering it, but yes, I do think there's plenty of material here to make it a one-hour episode, and I think it works.
Well, obviously, I agree. Watching this episode, like you, I've seen it hundreds of times. Watching it over again for the purposes of writing notes, I laughed out loud so many times.
Oh, my God.
That I was like, wow, this one's way funnier than I remember it being.
It's so rapid fire. There are so many one-liners that are in there that just bam, 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 bam. And again, because, in a weird way, I know this is going to sound strange, but MASH is like wallpaper. You know, we've been watching it for so long.
Yeah.
And we have it on in the background, and if we're flipping through the channels, and we're doing folding the laundry, it's like, oh, MASH is on.
I'll watch 10 minutes of that one or whatever. Right,
yes, exactly. Or I'll just put it on and I'll say, what do I feel like watching? Oh, I feel like watching a MASH, and I'm folding the laundry and I'm listening, and I'm watching. But when you actually sit down and watch and you are reminded is just how on it the writers were. And how on it the actors were. This is MASH season 5. Well, season 4 and 5 as a whole is MASH at the top of its game, which we've discussed. And this episode is a great flip side, I think, to Welcome to Korea, where here now you see them all at the height of their powers, to borrow a cliched phrase, where you see this is not an episode that would have been the same way if Henry were in charge. But the way Potter takes command, and you really see him as a commander, not just as a mentor or as a father figure or what have you. He's a commander. I mean, he knows what to do in a crisis. Let's get it done. And he, like you said, he has to put Frank in charge. He doesn't want to, but he has to. I mean, so
his Me, sir? Like, no choice.
his disdain for Burns is just tangible how much he can't stand Burns, and which is great, but he's the boss, and that's something that you just usually on the show, the boss, like a boss type character, was a character to be loathed, and here you just respect the hell out of him. He's just taken everything into consideration. He knows what needs to be done. He's been down this road before. And what I like about that is that it's the opposite of Welcome to Korea, where it's fish out of water story for BJ. Here, BJ's he's in the swing of things. He's a member of the team. Everybody knows each other. They've got an easy rapport. And the same thing with Potter. You know, Potter wasn't even in the season premiere from the previous season, and now it's the season premiere, and he's running the damn show. So it's a really interesting way of looking at the show's development when you compare the two shows back to back.
Absolutely. MASH writer Ken Levine, who actually started writing with the show this season, made a comment on his blog a long time ago where he said, if you see a sitcom doing an hour-long show, he said what happened was they wrote the show and they had 40 minutes of story.
Right.
Too much for a half hour, but not enough for an hour. And he goes, and then they just pad it to get to 51 minutes or whatever. And he says, that's generally what happens now. But in this case, I'd say that is not true. Bug Out feels full. Yes. There doesn't feel there's any padding. I think MASH actually did pretty good one-hour shows. Again, we've already talked about how much Welcome to Korea is part of it. Yeah. The show opens with Hawkeye and BJ with their deck chairs, watching the digging of the latrine. And it's a very Hawkeye and Trapper moment. Right. They've got the umbrella. And that's meant as a compliment, is that, like, as you just said, BJ is now fully acclimated.
Yes.
This is something, you know, he's now part of the rhythm. He's getting into Hawkeye's weird things of just making a day of it, of just sitting and watching them take a latrine, you know.
I think he says, this is my first latrine digging. And Hawkeye's was, oh, you need to come downtown more often.
Yeah, it's totally what it is. And this is the first season of the show without Larry Gelbart. Larry Gelbart left the show at that point, and not that there weren't phenomenal writers on the show. I already mentioned that this one is written by Fritzell and Greenbaum, who are masterful writers. Yeah. But nevertheless, it says something that this show and the remaining of season five is as funny as it is, considering what a loss Larry Gelbart was. Larry Gelbart was a comedic genius. Yeah. And the show was so strong that it could keep going without him. Now, of course, we noticed some changes in the opening credits. William Christopher is listed in the credits for the first time. And he'll, of course, be a regular until the show ends. And then we get an executive producer credit, which is executive producer Gene Reynolds. And that will be the only time this season that any sort of crew member is listed in the front credits. So the before this and after this, it was just the cast. But that's Gene Reynolds, who had fully taken over the show at this point, gave himself, I guess, that credit at the end there. So after the scene with Hawkeye, oh, by the way, the scene where they're digging the latrine, we see Jeff Maxwell, of course, digging. And at one point they talk about, they refer to someone as Salkowitz.
Yeah.
And he answers. Jeff Maxwell answers. And so it's like, wait a minute, that's not Salkowitz. That's Igor. I don't know why they constantly felt like they just didn't have to bother like keeping it consistent with him. But nevertheless, and they make the joke about dig a little deeper. That's Frank Burns. That's Major Burns is in. And so then the next scene is in Radar's office, and Klinger comes in. Radar is sewing his pants. There's a delivery of a box of cigars to Klinger. And there's a joke it's not even a joke, it's just a reference that makes no sense to me, is where he talks about how exclusive these cigars are. And he says, I get one box a year, limited. And he says, for $8 a box, which is, you know, back then a lot of money.
Sure.
And he says, the rest go to Milton Berle, Nelson Rockefeller, and Bishop Sheen. Now, does that mean they make four boxes a year and Klinger is on that list? Is that what that means?
I think that's probably the joke, because those were all cigar smokers. So he's just making a gag about people, you know, like, hey, Milton Berle, how many pictures have you seen him? He's always with a cigar. I mean, even when he played Louis the Lilac, he had a cigar. So I think that was just a you know, one of their many pop culture references that were of the moment, but, you know, over the course of the decades kind of loses a little bit of impact because people don't necessarily even remember who Bishop Sheen was.
Wow. Yeah. But I mean, the joke is that they literally just make
so
four
exclusive.
Boxes.
It's so, yeah, it's the so Klinger exclusive. Is on the Klinger's list. On the list with Milton Berle. Yeah.
There's four boxes, the Nelson Rockefeller and Maxwell Q. Klinger, all the way over in Korea. And, of course, he sniffs the cigar, and he says, would you ask Radar, would you like to sniff it? And Radar has the joke, yeah, I've never been to New Jersey. So MASH never fails to get a New Jersey joke in. When ever.
And also, you know, another thing about Klinger, because this is also a great Klinger episode, is that Klinger's also at max well, pardon the pun, but Maximum Clinger. You know, he's not silly. He is a great character, and it's like he's become the platonic ideal of Clinger by this time. And you know, all of the gags and all of the sly commentary, even the way he deals with Major Burns, is just Jamie Farr. You know, he doesn't, you know, because it's an hour long episode and he's obviously not the focus of it, but he makes the absolute most of every scene he's in this episode.
I also love that he's dressed like a 1920s flapper for some reason. like even when he's dressed in women's clothes, he's out of date by 20 years. Like,
right.
Well, looks like from the Great Gatsby or something.
He always did that. And that was the best part, is that it became part of the gag was how much care. And of course, you get the big payoff in this particular episode.
Yes.
How much care he takes with in his clothes.
Yeah,
and that's always one of the recurring jokes too, is that how sometimes he'll walk into the swamp, and the others will kind of critique what he's wearing. It's like, wow, you know, oh, evening wear in the daytime, Clinger, and yeah. You know, all of that stuff, which is great. And it's like. You wonder, because, you know, I mean, this is all the writer's decision to put him in these outfits. But I do like imagining Clinger's thought process when he gets up in the morning. You know, like, how does he figure out what he's going to wear that day? You know, how does he figure, today's the day I'm going to dress a 20s flapper?
Yeah. Where does he even get all this stuff? Like, where is this coming from?
We actually learn in this. He makes these references of everything that he's had to do for 3 years. You know, I have basically sewn my fingers to the bone putting this thing together, and all of the places he's gone, dodging sniper fire to get the right material. That's great.
You got to admire the commitment to the bit. That is exactly, for damn sure. Exactly. Even when he knows it's never going to work at this point.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, Radar gets a phone call, and they Clinger wonders, oh, it's a USO show. Bob Hope and Broads, and Radar responds, Dobrich's dogs. And I had no idea what that was. I had to look that up. And Dobrich was apparently a dog trainer. It was a famous, like, it was like a school of dog training. And I guess that Dobrich, I'm assuming it was a man, but I don't know, had like an act where dogs did stuff. So it doesn't sound like the kind of thing that really would pack them in. as opposed to Bob Hope and a bunch of sexy girls is a dog act. Like, oh, wow, that's exciting.
Right.
And Clinger has the reaction. It's just our luck, you know. It's just not excited about that. He puffs on the cigar, and, you know, Potter. And this is the beginning of the beginning of the rumor that they're going to be bugging out. And that's how it all gets started, which, again, it's an amazingly – I mean, the idea of – slip of the lip can sink a ship and all that stuff. That's been with us, been through society for decades, hundreds of years, even at this point. But man, we're living through it so much right now, even with the most sophisticated computers at our fingertips, people still relay horribly bad information all the time. Yeah. And it's just, so it's an evergreen kind of thing. So this plot sort of works forever. So I love that Clinger shows up in the mess tent. And he, of course, tells Frank and Margaret that they're bugging out. And he's like, Frank is, of course, bothered by that horribly, because he's like, that's anti-American that you would spread, rumor like that. And then, of course, as soon as Hawkeye and BJ walk in, Frank can't wait to spread that exact rumor that he just heard. So it's like he's accusing Clinger of being un-American, and then he just immediately does what he just accuses the Clinger of doing.
Right. Well, it's not just that. It's also the way he does it. It's
we know something, you,
something
don't.
You don't.
Yeah.
It's like he's an eighth grader, and Hawkeye comes back with such a dirty response that gets lost if you know he's what, Margaret's a brunette,
yeah,
and it's like, Jesus, how did they get that one past the censors? You know, I mean, it's very, very funny line, but it also shows you that, you know, that's how rapid fire they were working. But also, I mean, it's just, it's a dirty joke on a early primetime episode.
Yeah. I also love his response when he says, "What guess what's happening?" And BJ says, or Hawkeye says, "Santa Claus is coming to town." And Frank goes, "He is not." He's offended. He's offended on some level that he would say that about Santa Claus. So then we get Frank, and Frank ramps up the rumor. He takes what Klinger told him, and he changes it to a battalion of North Koreans is headed this way. And there's a great little detail. Again, I've been going on and on about this, especially across like seasons 3 and 4. But I love Margaret's reaction. We see her look at Frank,
right?
And her face kind of like her brow kind of furrows because she's like, "Wait a minute, why is he saying that?" And I love that. That's a subtle little thing where she's noticing. Wait a minute, that's not what Klinger just said. And I think that now she should say something, but I like that there's even that moment where she's kind of looking at him like, "Hey, whoa, 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 wait a minute. But this is getting out of hand.
See, I don't know how much of it was intentional and how much of it was planned, but this goes back to the kind of the salvation or the reclamation of Margaret Houlihan, is that throughout season 4, Frank and Margaret argue quite a bit. There is, you know, there's a lot of episodes where the two of them, where basically he's driving her crazy. And again, I don't know if they were laying the groundwork or they were just mining good comedy material of having the two, you know, nominal villains, sniping at each other. But here, you know, this is still the old one joke Margaret. Like I even said, you know, Alan Alda's dirty joke is it's all about that one, still that one note Margaret, where she's got the bun on top of her head, which is not the most flattering look.
She's very stern.
She's very officious and all of that. But even when Frank starts going around the bend with his story, she gives him a look like, "Frank, what are you talking about?" But for whatever reason, she doesn't feel like she wants to contradict him, you know, it's not entirely sure, but then her attraction to Frank Burns has never been something that's entirely explainable. But to see that is, it's like, this is the last gasp of Margaret, because from this point forward, once the show really gets cooking, Margaret becomes a key part of the viewer's perspective, which was not usually her role. Her role was usually the foil, and I know I'm jumping ahead here, but for example, when she becomes genuinely alarmed and says something that I don't think they ever used the word on the show, where she says, "Do the Chinese rape their women prisoners?" Mm. And it's a really dark moment, because the show usually danced around certain parts of warfare, and it's like they go right for it here, and you see Margaret in that one moment. She's incredibly vulnerable, and you see that she's actually terrified, and they never really showed that with her in the past that much. It was always that she was always, you know, like almost without feeling. And now you, for the first time, really are like, Jesus Christ, how much would it suck to be Margaret in this situation? That's horrible. And to even have to think that way is just, it's brutal. It's an interesting way that in the middle of this rapid fire hilarious episode, they drop that in like 3 times.
Yeah, in previous shows where they would, when they would make that kind of hint, they would use other colloquialisms for it.
Yeah,
they would say "ravage" or something like something a little more florid. But they go straight forward here, and the word is very jarring.
Yeah, and
as we'll get to it, we'll see that they give Hawkeye the proper reaction to that that scene. And I mean, we'll never really know, because unfortunately, so many of the MASH crew is no longer with us, or whatever. But like, it's Margaret as a character got short shrift a little in season 4, simply because Loretta Swit wasn't around. She was doing plays, and she just was just unavailable. Yeah. So she missed out on a lot of really great episodes of The Interview, for one, and things like that. Right. And I feel like they're making up for that with season 5, because she gets clearly the biggest character turn across season 5, the most development in season 5. So I almost feel like they were saying, okay, she was in stasis a little in season 4, but now we're really going to push her forward.
But I think it's bigger than that. I think that with season four and five as a whole, and I'm sorry, season 5 and 6 as a whole, is because they said that they were going to, and then I know that this is next week's episode, I do need to refer to it, is her, you know, when they got the idea to marry her, the whole idea was to get her divorced, not married.
Yep.
And that was the plan from the jump. And the way that they play that out, and the way that they play it out here, is that part of it was, I think, and again, I don't know if there's how much discussion there was behind the scenes, but Margaret was the only female cast member, and she was cast in it in such an unflattering light that, and given what was going on in society, we're talking the early to mid 70s and the women's liberation movement and the Equal Rights Amendment battles and the show's very, you know, stout liberal heart. Somebody somewhere along the line says, we're not doing right for this character. This is a character that actually has the potential that we could explore all sorts of themes if we actually humanize her, as opposed to making her a one-note gag. And I don't know if this was Loretta Swit who pushed for this, or the producers, or Alan Alda, or whomever, but I still think it was a brilliant, brilliant and much needed change for the show. And we get to see a lot of that in this episode, where we see Margaret as a human, as a capable, dedicated, loyal, but vulnerable human being. And we get to see these things. And we got glimpses of it till now, but we really do get to see it in this episode. And it's a great way of introducing really where they're going to take the character.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So next up, we see that the rumor is continuing in the showers, where Father Mulcahy says there's an army of paratroopers, Chinese paratroopers, yes. A battalion of Chinese paratroopers. And Potter has to cut him off, and he says, look, it looks like last week. What would happen to the Radio City Rockettes were supposed to be here? What did we get? An Italian sissy who played Valencia with his armpit. And there's so many things here. First of all, and there's going to be a couple examples across this episode, and I'll mention them when we get to them. But Colonel Potter of course, Harry Morgan, not so much Colonel Potter. Harry Morgan had a way of delivering lines that in someone else's hands could sound offensive. Referring to someone as an Italian sissy, it just could be like, I don't know. But he doesn't. He just doesn't mean it in a mean way. He just doesn't.
And not just that, but it's also at the time, sissy was a word. It was a common insult.
Yeah.
And I'm watching it, and my wife turns to me, and she says, holy shit, he just said sissy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I know, but it was 1976. But yes, the way that he it just, despite myself, it was an incredibly funny line, and you're right, and because then he starts to play with his armpit at the same time, and he just does it deadpan, and of course it's funnier that he's in the shower, and he'd been singing also a kind of a risque old, you know, drinking tune, and
yeah.
Father Mulcahy walks in, and he's like, oh, sorry, Father.
Yeah.
You know? It's great.
Yeah, and there is something that we don't ever see the Italian sissy. We just have to imagine in our minds as to what that looked like. I will say in syndication, they cut the sequence of Potter making the armpit sounds. They cut it entirely. And I was actually kind of glad for that, because I just find the armpit thing to be not funny. And it's like, you know what? Once in a while, MASH could be lowbrow.
Yeah, now, see, that's in a while. The idea of Potter in the shower making armpit noises to me is just hysterical.
And Mulcahy's rocking along with it.
Yeah.
Like, he starts going like, that. Yeah, it's very, very silly. So, okay, yeah. There you go. So anyway, wounded arrive. Potter gets out of his gets out of the shower, and then they're pretty full up. We see pre-op, and there's a lot of patients. And there's another scene that's in this episode that was always cut in syndication, where a soldier who is clearly kind of delirious grabs Frank and refers to him as Alice. And he's like, let me go. That is cut in syndication. I've never seen it in syndication. Well, I mean, not never seen it, but I never saw it in syndication. So then in a moment when they look at the x-ray and they see that the patient has the spinal injury, and Hawkeye has the line about, you know, you always give me the cuties, which I thought was great. And then Potter says, well, I'm sure as hell I'm not going to give this one to Alice, referring, of course, to Burns.
Burns, and yeah.
With the setup cut, I never understood that reference. All the times I saw the episode, I was like, what is that even? Why does he call it? Why is he calling Burns Alice? I don't even understand what that means. So,
I wasn't even aware of that because that's fascinating. But you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Otherwise, it just sounds like one of Potter's aphorisms.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give it to Alice, you know.
Yeah.
Which could be like some old country saying, but you're right. It's put off to a gag that has a direct setup.
Yeah, it's just sort of strange. And so then they talk about, can we get a neurosurgeon from the 863rd? Potter says, no chance. Again, I like that little bit of continuity that, you know, they have referred to the fact that there is a neurosurgeon at the 863rd. So it's like, that's something they've referred to a couple of times. And there's this scene, and I actually, had the good fortune to be able to mention this directly to Jamie Farr, which is just crazy. I love this moment where after Potter walks away, Hawkeye goes back to looking at the X-ray to sort of examine. And I love that Klinger is looking at the X-ray. That's just a great detail that Klinger, he doesn't need to know any of this stuff. He's an orderly, but he, on some level, is trying to kind of pay attention to what's going on.
Well,
and
he also,
it's great.
Well, isn't it Klinger who also puts up the X-ray onto the light box to begin with? And I think he calls them over. Like, he recognizes that something is wrong because, even though, again, you say he's not a doctor or anything, but he's been around and seen so much. And even later in the episode where Potter refers to him as a first-rate medic, which is something that, again, with the show, they've always been a little loose with what their duties are. You know, the non-doctors, Radar, we know, company clerk. But Klinger and the rest of them, they all, sometimes they're peeling potatoes, sometimes they're digging latrines, sometimes they're doing this, doing the other. So to refer to him as a medic, I thought was kind of interesting. But I think it's Klinger who kind of raises the first alarm to say, you need to see this.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. I mean, I would imagine that if you worked in this situation and you were not a medical professional, you would start to pick up some stuff. You have to. It's the currency of the place, I mean, what can you do? So Potter takes a call from General Hamilton, who tells him that there is absolutely no bug out happening at all. So they tell Hawkeye, all right, go ahead and start operating on the guy. And then we go to the operating room. And I love this scene where we see Hawkeye is a little snippy with Margaret and BJ. He says to Margaret, why didn't you put the X-ray where I can see it? And then, BJ turns it. And then the patient starts to kind of go, a little like he's not quite out enough. And Hawkeye chastises BJ for that. And he says, I thought I gave him enough. And he says, well, don't think, be sure. And I love that BJ pushes back on him. Yeah. And BJ goes, I'm sorry. And there's that moment where Hawkeye says, all right, I'm sorry. And I love that, yes, Hawkeye is a cool cucumber, as we've seen. Henry literally even called him that in one episode where he did open heart massage. But this is scaring Hawkeye. And it's scaring him to the point where he's even being snippy with his best friend. And I think, again, a great detail.
Yeah, and it's also a nice payoff, again, just shows the writing of the setup, is that when Potter gives him, gives him the assignment, he says to him, well, you've got a new specialty. It's just shorthand acknowledgement that, these guys, these people, the nurses and the doctors, so often had to make it up as they went along because they had to deal with everything, even with what they were not prepared or trained for as physicians. And they had to improvise. And that's always been a sub theme anyway with the whole medical aspect of the show. But you see Hawkeye, who is up to this point widely acknowledged as the best surgeon in the place until Charles comes along, and even he's not sure he can pull this one out.
Yep.
And he knows how delicate, and so he is. He's kind of a dick to both of them. And you're used to him being that way with Margaret, because sometimes he could be very snappish with the nurses during intense surgeries anyway. But to see him turn that way on BJ is like, that's really does say something.
Yeah, that's great. Again, I love that BJ pushes back, that he can, be like, hey, all right, relax.
Yeah.
So then there's a scene where Frank investigates the latrine and he has a line with Igor where he says, I want another foot deeper here. And Igor says, your end, never mind my end. Again, lowbrow joke. You know, like we already had like a, you meant there was the Margaret Dirty joke, and now there's like an armpit joke, and now there's like sort of a poop joke. So, I mean, like, you know, they're doing lots of sorts of jokes across this episode. And then we go to Potter's office, and here is, if, you know, if you need a guest actor to come in and just deliver some laughs, you cannot do better than the great Richard Lee Sung, who unfortunately just passed away last year on August 16th, my birthday, passed away on August 16th, 2021, as Cho Man Chin, a quasi-real estate developer. Literally every line out of this guy's mouth is funny. I mean, literally everything. Yeah. And so
it's his delivery.
His delivery is flawless. Yeah. Absolutely flawless. And so he tells... Potter tells Radar to tell Cho Man Chin that he doesn't want to see him, even though Cho Man Chin is standing right there. So I think he's thought you're outside. I was outside, now inside. And then so he says, should I remove him? And Potter says, he'd bite your neck and give you the gleet. Now, first of all, I had to look that up, what the gleet was. The gleet means, basically, the gleet is like a social disease. Is a
and he's offended. Yes.
Yeah. And then you get Cho Man Chin has the absolute perfect, because there's this pause, and Cho Man Chin goes, Colonel, go for laugh, no get. Which is
right. Exactly. Exactly. It's great.
It's just making the subtext text of just making the Colonel go for laugh, no get. So then Radar leaves with the sandwich, this cold spam sandwich that Colonel Potter doesn't want to eat, and they won't warm it up because the kitchen has been shut down due to the bug out supposedly, and you know Potter sends Radar out, tells him to warm up the stove, and then they go through this, Potter and Cho Man Chin go through this litany of like wild boar's tusks that were fake. You know, more time, you can't even trust the animals. I mean, just
guy the just watches like, that run backwards.
Watches that run backwards. Sold out. I mean, just he just will not give up. So then there's another moment where, again, Colonel Potter gets away with a joke that most people could not, where he says, no, boss, you moving. And Potter goes, we no move. And then he stops himself and goes, oh, he says, now I'm talking like you. And
it's like, yeah, exactly.
That could be a little insensitive, but it's the way Potter says it. It's just.
Yeah,
it's so not meant to be that way that you just laugh that he's caught up in himself that he's talking. The Cho Man Chin the way he is. So then Radar brings back the sandwich and he says, it's warm now. Got the stove set up, kept it under my arm. And Potter just goes, pass.
He doesn't even miss a beat. He just is like, pass.
Oh my lord. Like, what? Oh my god. So Cho Man Chin has this blueprint. Where the hell did he get this blueprint? Like, you see the size of the paper? Like, where did he get that? At a local Kinko's?
Like, it's like he went down to the local city hall to get all the zoning variances and all. It is such a, you're right, it's a really funny sight gag that you take for granted. Because, of course, why in the world would he have all that?
A map of Korea? Like, why does he have that? Yeah. It's like,
and he's referring to them as by the lot's name.
Yeah.
Oh, he is lot number, whatever.
Two trees, one green, one brown. You know, he's got the whole bit. And then we find out, Richard Lee Sung, man, he just cannot, that guy just cleaned up the minute he
incredibly
would show up.
Funny.
So then Frank shows up, and we find out that Frank bought one of the watches that runs backwards. And of course, Cho Man Chin's response is, try other wrists. And Frank tries that for a moment. oh my god. So anyway, Potter calls assembly, and we only see that it's only about 20 people. Presumably everybody's else busy working or something, but so he goes on this whole long thing about it's grade A bull cookies. Service people should know that it's as scuttlebutt is as common as cooties in your skivvies.
Yes.
And then he says, my apologies to those monks of the feminine gland and our resident celibate.
I howled because again he did it in that Potter natural cadence that he just said the feminine gland or the female gland.
It's like, what?
And then Mulcahy just kind of has this look.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. That doesn't make me feminine that I'm a sell. Like, you don't need to point that out, you know? It's like, okay, all right. So that's fine. So he goes through this whole thing about, you know, rumors that he heard that one time his unit was told that Nazis were going to be taking over Eskimos. And he goes, hard to believe our unit started hoarding canned salmon. It was this whole, again, another installment of the Young Sherman Potter Chronicles, all these crazy things that we heard. And then he says, we're not bugging out right at the moment where Radar brings the note saying we are, in fact, bugging out, which leads to this mad scramble of everybody. Radar breaks into the operating room and tells them that we are bugging out. And he's like, oh, God, we can't stop now. And Hawkeye's just like, well, all right. And then we get to the sequence. This is kind of what you were talking about at the top of the show. They really went for the big, you know, the big production here, because we see all the trucks come in. We see the actors or at least the stunt people like pulling down the tents. And it's not faked. It's really out on the lot. So they really did this. They really took all this stuff down, and that's big. It's a 1 hour debut, but it feels like you said almost a movie size story.
It because the military aspect of the show. I mean, you generally speaking, you would hear explosions in the distance or explosions near the camp, and you'd have them react to it, and maybe they'd have to go up to an aid station and all of that. But here you actually see one of the rare times where it's just military in action, and the music that they use too, the sort of, you know, the drum and bugle sort of dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum. And you see everybody is all about their business. You know, except for Frank, who can't get out of his own way. Everybody is doing what needs to be done in that moment, and you, because again, you know, the mobile part of MASH, you know, which is played for laughs in a different episode, it's a reminder that sometimes they did actually have to move.
Yep.
Because that was the whole point. That was the whole point of creating these hospitals. And in the Korean War, this was the first time that they had had this. This was an experiment. So to actually see that part of it and to do it in a two-part episode, I thought it really lent itself to that kind of cinematic feel that helped elevate it to make it worthy of a two-parter.
Yeah.
Because it gives it that sense of scope that you're not used to seeing.
Yeah. I love, so Potter tells presumably a private, this guy named Kelsey, and he says, keep those tent stakes. We'll need them at the new location. He puts Burns in charge. I love that he's like, me? And he's like, no choice. You're second in command. It's just like, I don't, you know. And then he gives Frank the list of, you know, what order to break stuff down in. They go diverse, you know, the op and then the mess tent and supply, yada, yada, yada. And then, of course, what's Burns' official, first official duty as the guy in charge of the bug out? He tells Kelsey, forget the tent stakes. We'll make new ones.
Right.
And he literally smacks them out of Kelsey's hand.
Yeah.
And then you get another moment of the Young Sherman Chronicles, Sherman Potter Chronicles, where he says he sees Frank do that. And he just sort of grimaces to no one in particular. And he says, why didn't I shoot my foot and stay in Honolulu? I love the double whammy of that. First of all, why would you ever leave Honolulu for any reason? And then secondly, how would you get shot in Honolulu? Like, how would that even work? It's a fake, a fake injury. Like, were there a lot of enemy crawling around in Honolulu that you would get shot at? Like, how does it even work? So Hawkeye and BJ and Margaret are operating, and then we get the sequence of, as you mentioned, the gum, bum, 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 bum music. Some of this footage would be reused for Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen in season 11. They didn't quite pay attention that there. Wow. If you look closely,
I didn't realize that
a couple of the scenes in Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen, you see Radar packing up one of the tents.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. It goes by really, it's far away, but you see him. Wow. He's there. So, I mean, you know, they had the footage, might as well reuse it. So we see everybody packing up the tents. Frank yells at a private and he says, if you don't, you don't be careful, you're going to have you busted. And the guy says, I'm a private. And Frank says, don't pull rank on me. I could not find a credit for that actor, unfortunately, in this episode on IMDb, even though he's got a line.
Yeah.
Normally, but I didn't see him fun. And Klinger is packing up the toilet paper, which, of course, that's a big deal. You have to have that. And then we get this shot of the OR completely empty, except for the one table. And it is a little spooky.
It's haunting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It shows it makes them look really vulnerable.
We're not used to seeing that. To just seeing this big empty set. There's a scene in Klinger's tent where Frank tells him he's not allowed to bring any of his dresses. And then, of course, he gets up in Radar's grill because Radar wants to bring all of his animals and stuff. And we see that all Frank is doing is just getting in the way. Like, the amount of time it's taking to argue, you could have just put this stuff on the truck.
Yeah.
So he's just horrible at this. And then, of course, he has another argument in the swamp, which is also empty, where he's arguing with BJ that he will not be able to pack the still. So it's like Frank's just... he's just terrible. He's just absolutely terrible.
It's also an interesting, in a weird way, it's a commentary too about how the others are trying, and not to put too fine a point on it, the others are still trying to preserve their humanity.
Mm.
They're trying, you know, they're in the middle of this chaotic, but they will not give up who they are. You know, they have to move, but damn it, from Radar's perspective, the animals are coming with me.
Yep.
Klinger is like, the dresses are coming with me. You know, BJ's like, the still is coming with us. And of course, Frank, who has zero empathy, doesn't understand at all why they would want to do this. They think that he thinks that they're being
unmilitary.
Unmilitary-like, wasteful, all of this. And really all it is that they are just still trying to be the people they are. And again, I don't know how much of that was just done to make Frank look like an asshole or whether there was subtext, but that's the common theme to all of those things, is that they're still clinging to the things that make MASH MASH and make them who they are, mm-hmm. as opposed to Frank, who's just, a ridiculous sort of machine. Yeah.
And I really, as a child, I really empathize with Radar, because when Frank says, those animals are not coming, and Radar says something like, didn't you have a pet as a child, Major? Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, we've talked about here in our apartment, like we've talked about what would happen if we had to get out because of a fire. And our first concern is the dog. That's our first concern, Absolutely. And it's like this idea that Frank would be so dismissive. Like, these are not Radar's. These are not just animals. These are Radar's pets. They are.
Well, he even says they're my friends.
My friends. Yeah, right.
They're
right.
My friends. It's and again, it's a case where what seems so natural to someone as kind as Radar it mystifies him that Frank could be that cruel. He's like, he's kind of struggling with it. And it's not, Radar is not one to talk back like that. And he just was like, I just thought that was a great moment. And of course, Gary Berghoff is always a great secret weapon, not so secret weapon on the show anyway, no matter what angle he's coming from.
Yeah, it's marvelous. So back in the swamp again, they get the argument about the still, and of course BJ decides to retort by saying, "All right, let's see what kind of stuff you're bringing." And he, one of the great gags is he pulls out what looks like a bra, like a black lacy bra, and he goes, "Frank." And Frank goes, "It's a gift for a fellow officer." And BJ's response is, "It's not Colonel Potter's size." Great. this is great rat-a-tat-tat thing.
Yeah.
So then we see Colonel Potter in the chopper looking for and he's got a map. And I swear to God, he's using
Chomich's
map.
Yeah, it probably is.
It's the same one. Yeah. And he's in this chopper. And the pilot is this guy named, he's referred to as Barry. The pilot is an actor named Barry Cahill. So I guess they just decided, well, just call him Barry. He passed away in 2012, and he had a lot of pretty impressive movie credits. He was in Clint Eastwood's Hang 'Em High, Pam Grier's Coffee, and Tick, 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 which is one of the last movies featuring Frederick March, is one of my all-time favorite actors. So he had a pretty nice career here. Anyway, so they find this unit and the space, and they say there's a road, there's some drainage, there's some good, okay, we found it, we're going to head back. So then we're back at the post-op, and Hawkeye is looking over his patient, and this soldier comes in and basically says, "I need that chair," which is ridiculous. I mean, there's only one chair. You can leave one chair behind. And this actor is a guy named James Carroll, although he's credited here as James Lough or Loaf, L-O-U-G-H. I don't fully understand that. He was on seven different MASHes, mm-hmm. always kind of playing this sort of guy. He was on TV shows like Knight Rider, Dallas, Fall Guy. And then he was in the recent movie Minari, which was nominated for a Best Picture Oscar.
He was in Minari?
Years ago. Yeah. Apparently he's kidding. In Minari. Yeah. So, wow. I mean, he's still going on. And I absolutely love when Hawkeye talks about, he says, if Frank Burns comes to get me, I'm going to attack him with my gluteus maximus, the vertical smile. He does all these sort of Hawkeye-isms, and the guy has no idea what he's talking about. And then he says this great line. He says, Doc, I never even graduated high school.
I graduated.
I love graduated. That is just fantastic. I just graduated high school. And Hawkeye's just like, all right, you can go. And then he sort of slinks off, and I love that Potter notices it, and he's like, what's his problem? That's great. I love that. What's his problem? I love that he picks up on that. That's great. So Hawkeye and Potter have a little talk about, you know, he can't be moved. And Potter's like, I know that, but if you hear, you see a cloud of dust and you hear Chinese band music, get that kid on a chopper and get your butt out of here. And then there's a marvelous line, which is, you know, underscoring how attached these people have become to each other so soon, where as Potter leaves, he says, don't forget, my wife is looking forward to meeting you.
Oh, that's a great line.
I love that line. I love that they've established that at this point, that it's like, we're going to see each other, you know, back in the States, and you can't get killed. You have to make it home. It's marvelous.
It's a wonderful line, and the way he delivers it, almost like an afterthought and is a casual part of the conversation, but it is so incredibly meaningful about what he's saying. And it's also an acknowledgement of not only just how much he cares, but how dangerous the situation is. It's those little moments, those little lines that I find so incredibly impressive about the writing in MASH, the things that we take for granted, the little lines, the little, what's really a throwaway actually has a lot of meaning behind it. And the way it's delivered is really beautiful. Just the way he just kind of tosses it over his shoulder. And it's like, Jesus, it really lands hard when you realize, again, they're reminding you in all these different ways of just how high the stakes are with what's going on.
Absolutely. So Margaret tells Hawkeye that she is staying, and he does a quick joke. You know, he's like, "Oh, I'm touched and aroused." You know, he's
right, because he still can't help himself.
Yeah, and then you know he sort of softens up, and then he heads back to the swamp. We see that it's just a framework at that point again, and they emphasize that by Gene Reynolds emphasizes that by putting the camera way high up, much higher up than you would ever see. But he does it so you were shooting through what would normally be the roof of the tent.
Yeah.
And there is no roof. It's all just exposed. So again, that's a great little directorial touch to sort of remind everybody, hey, look, you'd normally be seeing the ceiling to this thing, but the ceiling's gone. There's no tent anymore. And Hawkeye is, of course, bothered that the still is gone. And then Radar reveals that he made special arrangements to get the still and his animals and Klinger's dresses moved to the new unit. And I love Hawkeye just does that warm hug around Radar's shoulder, where he just hugs him because he's like, oh, man, you know, like, you're just the best, Radar. It's fantastic.
And I love what he says to him. He says, when we get back to the States, I'm going to adopt you. Mm-hmm. And Radar's reaction is just that kind of like bashful giggle. Mm-hmm. That he's like, well, I've already got my mom and Uncle Ed. He's like, that's okay. I'll sleep on the couch.
Yeah. It's great. It's just so beautiful. So we see everybody leave, and then Radar decides to stay behind. And Hawkeye's like, what are you doing? He says, you might need me.
Yeah.
Again, a really wonderful piece of self-sacrifice on Radar's part. I got to wonder that he didn't I don't think he checked with Colonel Potter before he did.
No,
that.
I don't know if he did either.
That's kind of a gutsy thing. Yeah. So, and then we're back at back in post op, and we get to that moment that you talked about, where it's just Hawkeye and Margaret, and they examine the patient, and we hear the explosions, and Margaret talks about that it's so loud, and then she says to Hawkeye, "Does the enemy rape female prisoners?" And for once, Hawkeye takes it seriously, and he just says, "Margaret, there's no reason to be afraid." And it's a marvelous moment, as you talked about earlier. It's just great.
And really, also the thing is that it's a non-answer, because he can't actually answer the question, but he tries his best to comfort her in a way that really he can't, but he does his best and he's sincere about it. And she takes his sincerity. And these are those moments where, and again, there were episodes, I mean, they have had episodes, you know, prior to this, where there were moments, you know, in bonding between Margaret and Hawkeye. And this just lights it up a little bit further along. That they, even for all the sniping and even for everything, there's still a bond of respect. And in part, it's because of things just like this, where Margaret, of course, would want to stay behind. Margaret cares about the patient. Margaret, she knows that he needs a nurse. He can't be there. So even though she is taking great personal risk, as they all are, that she feels that it is her duty to do this. And it again takes Margaret past that one note character. Just the idea of Margaret exhibiting fear like that natural quiet, like not like the screaming and hollering and playing it for laughs kind of thing, but the, like, this is stark. This is a very quiet, fearful moment. And not only does she admit it, which is very difficult for Margaret to do, admit that kind of vulnerability, she does it with Hawkeye. And I just think that it's things like this that really deepen her character. And it's just one of a thousand things that are going to happen over the next two seasons. But I think it's really brilliantly executed by the writing staff. And of course, Loretta Swift is, you know, she's great.
Yeah, absolutely. So then they decide Hawkeye and Radar decide to go visit Rosie's one last time before it gets closed up. And as I love that they're leaving, Hawkeye says, why don't we stroll down to Main Street to the dry goods store and watch them undress the window dummies?
Yeah.
And Radar's response is, that's what we used to do every Saturday night. that was an evening out in Ottumwa, Iowa, is watching the dummies get undressed. This is fantastic. So then they go to Rosie's bar, and in this case, Rosie is played by Frances Fong, who passed away in 2012. She had TV credits like Mod Squad, Hawaiian Eye, Perry Mason. This was the first of two mashes she would do. She would not come back playing Rosie. She would come back as another character. And there's this, you know, great, all this, you know, wonderful sequence where, you know, they're begging her for the, you know, to get some drinks. And she's like, we got to flee. She gets the bar tab and it's $51.
Right.
How many drinks is that to have $51? And like, what, how much are these drinks? Like 10 cents, 15 cents?
Right. If that.
Yeah, like, well, that's like 1,000 drinks or something. Oh my God, you know. Yeah.
And that's another one of those things where we take a $50 bar tab for granted in 2022.
Oh man, yeah.
Because that's a night out, you know.
Yep.
And for that was like, how long has he been running that tab?
Yeah.
And also the fact that she trusted him to run a tab that long.
Yeah.
That how he was able to. You know, you just imagine how he was able to charm his way out of not paying the bar tab until now.
Yeah.
And even now he looks at it and he's like, he knows he can't. We never see him pay it, but we know he's got this look like, I can't get out of this.
Yeah.
You know? He's like, and where am I going to come up with the money?
$50 in his scrubs? Like, right. How did that even work? You know, whatever. Right. And we see that the front, they are literally at the front because the trucks are roaring by Rosie's door, and they can't even get they don't even have a way to pass until Hawkeye kind of, you know, probably not intentional, but a callback to Welcome to Korea, where Radar pretends to be kind of sick, and Hawkeye has to kind of carry him over his shoulders across the road, and that stops the truck long enough for them to cross. So again, it's kind of like when, you know, they pretended Radar had the neurofraxia to get through the thing, and he's trying to bite his elbow and stuff like that. So, but you know, so there, the actor playing the soldier, who the captain who tells Hawkeye that you're standing on the front, is Don Eitner. He passed away in 2018. He was on TV shows like Quincy, The Powers of Matthew Starr. Remember that show? And then Dynasty. And then we get to the new unit, and we discover this hut and this whole sequence. Well, first of all, the prayer is right out of like an Abbott and Costello thing, where Father McKay wants to bless the new site, and Frank decides to yell each part of the prayer back, and it becomes a chain. And we see BJ yell back, you know, hear me, O Lord, hear me, O Lord, hear me. And it just goes on and on and on until the point that Potter Potter just tells him to zip it. The Padre does a single, as he says.
Yeah, right, exactly. But I also like, if you look at the look on DJ's face in the background, is that he's totally winding up Frank by doing it.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
he's encouraging Frank. This is fun. He's like, let's how absurd is this? So as soon as Frank yells out, BJ just repeats it and it just keeps going. And you can hear Nurse Kelly, you know, you can hear
her. She does it. Yeah, she does it.
She's one of the people who does it. But you can just, the look on BJ's face while this is happening is just, it's great because it just shows how absurd it all is.
Yeah, he knows he's getting Frank in trouble in front of Potter.
Yes, exactly.
You know? Fucking, yeah. And he'll never hear any grief from it.
No, never. Yeah.
So that leads to the sequence at the supposedly abandoned schoolhouse, which is really one of the great MASH set pieces, I'd say, of all time, they knock on the door and they hear some giggling. And Potter's like, giggling? And of course, BJ says, I haven't giggled since my wedding night. they knock on the door. And then a woman answers, and that actress is Eileen Sackey. She's the madam. She would go on to play Rosie.
In
season 7, Night at Rosie's, and she would be Rosie until the end of the series.
Yes. It was so funny. I was like, bang. She's perfect in this role.
Yeah. Oh, but she's brassy and whatever.
But that's also what made her such a great Rosie, because they show Rosie here to be a little bit more timid. Not the brassy tough one, and whose kind of personality you would need to survive in you're running a bar in a war zone, but you're basically getting just like kind of a rated PG-13 version of Rosie in the scene.
Yeah.
She's essentially the same character.
Yeah. And so I love that that they won't answer the door when Potter knocks and BJ.
Sorry, no appointment.
Yeah. Sorry, no appointment. What did you mean, no appointment? Yeah. And then BJ does the duck, 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 duck. And then he whistles, which gets him to open the door. And she comes out, and she's talking Korean. And again, there's another moment where any other person saying this line might be kind of a little offensive. But I love Potter just waves his hand. He says, don't give me that static. Like, refers to her language as static. Yeah. I just love that, you know. And then he's kind of slow to get it. And then she finally says, you know, concubines out, lady, now. And then she says, business before war, which is fantastic. And then he mentions that he's on command from Irving Hamilton. And she goes, oh, Binky.
That's just great.
And then Frank arrives. And are there people living here? And BJ says, the oldest profession. And that leads Frank to say, a bakery? What? Is that the only one? A bakery. I love that that's his go-to.
And he's so excited about the possibility.
Yeah, possibly that there's a bakery in the middle of Korean front. And, of course, they found the perfect – I would love to know the sequence of this, of like – did they reverse engineer the line? Did they say, okay, what's a colloquialism for hookers? Oh, tarts.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that could be a bakery then. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you fill it that way, because of course it's like, because Potter's response is tarts, which you wouldn't call them that in that context. And of course, because then Frank, peach, raspberry. He's like a little kid. He's just like a little kid.
Peach, raspberry.
He's so happy. And then, of course, I love that BJ is just enjoying all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's just having fun looking at Potter be so aggravated and looking at Frank totally not getting it. And he's just, you know, and then, you know, Frank says, you know, prostitutes in this building? And then you know, BJ says, well, if you order before 6, I'm sure you can get takeout. He's not helping at all. He's just not helping absolutely at all, which is just fantastic. So then Frank blows his whistle, which he's been blowing through the whole episode, and that leads Potter, who practically stamps his feet in frustration when he yanks it out of Burns' hand, and he's like, confiscated! He's so mad. Great. It's a great bit of physical comedy where he's just so frustrated and Burns at his stupid thing. So they can't get the girls out. They won't. I love, he says, You gotta, you have to set up your shimmy palace in another spot. All of these colloquialisms are just so good. Shimmy palace. I'm so frustrated. It's great. Oh my God. So then finally, they throw in a can of Vienna sausage and they think, oh, that's going to do it. But no, what happens is we see in the background, we see Klinger and his hangers full of dresses, and the girls get super excited and they come and they run out and they start grabbing the clothes, and Klinger's a really marvelous comic performance from Jamie Farr, desperately trying to keep the chaos at bay. You're going to tear it. Give me that dress. And this is fighting, whatever.
But it's also the details of this is where you get that moment where you get Klinger basically in trying to fend them off is also telling us everything he did to build this collection yes. that we've taken for granted.
Yep.
Because we just assume that the dresses appear, but the way he says, and I ran through gunfire for that one, and I did this one, and I sewed that one, and he would be very specific about the things they're damaging. No, that's real fake mint, fake fur, and all this kind of stuff, and just how much he knows his collection, how much he loves it, and how much a part of it of him it is. That he I mean, this is part of his identity that they're looking to rip away. And again, not to put too fine a point on it, but that's what makes it all land so funny, is that it just amps up everything we know about Klinger, but takes it to a new degree in the middle of this just bizarre circumstance. It's great.
It would sort of be like somebody rummaging through your comic collection, yes, you're like, hey, you know how long it took me to assemble that complete run of Justice League? What are you doing? Right. You know,
exactly.
Same thing. So I can understand that. So we have this little shot of, we see Klinger hunt one of the girls down and literally tackle her.
Right.
And then we cut away to BJ and Potter realizing Potter's like, I've got it. And then he says, Klinger. And Klinger says, all present and accounted for, sir. And I love that he is literally standing on the ass of one of the girls.
Yeah.
Forcing
like,
it. She's like
Tarzan.
She's thrashing madly. And he's got his foot on her pretty harshly, not really.
He's saluting at the same time.
Yeah, he's saluting. Yeah. And then he says, put it back on the rack next to the pink chiffon. Now watch the collar. It's simulated raccoon. Yeah. So, yeah, he is just full on like trying to preserve. And he's watching. It's funny. As Potter is talking to him, he's kind of looking over Potter's shoulder, watching the girls reassemble the collection, or maybe not in this case, but he's following what they're doing as Potter's trying to talk to him. So then Potter makes the argument, look, we need an OR, we need that. And then he finally appeals to Klinger's inherent patriotism, which, despite the goof on Klinger and that Klinger's always trying to get out, he is a patriot deep down. Yeah. And he says, we're going to, do it for Toledo.
Yeah,
and that's the one that sells it. That's what
that was. And he completely softens. Yeah. The look at Jamie Farr just completely softens. Like, you got me, and he's like, okay, sir, I understand. And you could tell he's just trying to keep a stiff upper lip.
Staying all night in the monkey, looking through the monkey ward catalog.
Great
detail. Yeah. So then they make the trade, and it's going to happen. And we cut back to MASH, and Margaret and Radar and Margaret and Hawkeye, are checking the patient, and we see that he is doing well. His blood pressure is back to normal, and they said he's pretty much going to be recovering from this. And it's dark out. And there's bombs going off, and everyone is scared. And Margaret even talks about, she says, how close is the enemy? And Radar says, we are in communist territory right now, which is, pretty terrifying. And then she asks again, she says, Corporal, have you heard if they're taking prisoners? And so you said, clearly this is in the forefront of Margaret's mind.
Yeah. So. And it is, it's a bit, and again, this is what was the genius of MASH, is taking those moments of terror and making them, her words are the way she delivers the lines, that she's trying so hard to keep it together in the middle of not only just this chaos, but then we almost immediately return to the jokes. Probably, actually, I think a little too fast in this case, but it again, I like the the contrast between that and the other things that we've been seeing. We do, you know, Klinger just gave up his dress collection. The next scene, Margaret's talking about, you know, being, you know, being raped again. It's just, it's really, it's very stark.
Yeah. So they morning comes, they hand the patient off to a chopper, they take off, and then Hawkeye and he stops the Jeep for a moment to just look at the unit, and we see that it's how abandoned it is. Yeah. And, you know, there's another great little moment here where Radar talks about, think of all the guys that we operated on. And Hawkeye goes, right, Doctor. And we see Radar's head kind of fall a little because he's just been sort of chastised by using the we there. And again, it's you know, I like that they would occasionally allow Hawkeye to be kind of a dick like that, you know? I mean,
because it's a dick move. It's a dick thing to say.
Yeah. I like that he says something. I mean, I understand as a doctor, you might be a little offended when other people refer to like, you know, but at the same time, it's like, look, you don't need to do that. And I love that they allowed Hawkeye that kind of shading that, you know, sometimes he could be an arrogant prick, you know, and it's the way he was. You feel bad when you hurt Radar. And of course the Jeep won't start, which was something they always used if they needed the characters to get into trouble. The Jeep doesn't start. That's always the way it was. And I love Radar says, let me check under the hood, and Hawkeye's like, yeah, make sure everything is still under there or whatever he says. So it's like, you know, that, what is that going to do? And then they hear the rumblings and they get scared that, oh my God, the Chinese are coming. There's a bit of physical humor where they all run into the swamp, try and hide, and there's no place to hide, of course, because there's nothing there. They hide behind posts. Radar literally stands behind a post like he's invisible or something. It's very Abbott Costello kind of physical humor. They peek around what looks like the supply shed, and we see that it's everybody. Everybody's coming back. Yeah. They decided that they Potter says they retook this area, and so we're coming home. Hawkeye lifts Margaret onto the back of Sophie. Again, there's another great detail when Hawkeye runs past all the Jeeps as they're coming in. He gives BJ a slap in the head, but he jumps into another Jeep. He jumps into the Jeep with the nurses. I love that. I love that. Like, he doesn't need to be in the same Jeep with BJ. He can go be with somebody. I just think that's a nice detail that, you know, Hawkeye's friends with everybody. It's not just the main character.
But it's also the women. It's his comfort zone too. I mean, he's just been through a harrowing experience, and now he just wants to flirt, you know, and be Hawkeye and get to be, you know, the goofy doctor who, you know, it's again not politically correct now, but you know, his raison d'être to hit on nurses. You know, it's very much in keeping with his personality.
Yeah, I realize that. I like that. And we have this wonderful triumphant music.
They
redo the score with the ba 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 ba. It's amazing how elastic that song was. That depending on how you played it, it could be very sad or be very triumphant, and it has that kind of feel to it where it's like, you know, it just seems like, oh, all right, everybody, you know, for the moment, this is as good as it's going to get. Everybody's back in their unit, back in the space that they want to be at. We do found that two of Radar's guinea pigs had babies, and Radar thinks that they are related. He's how'd that happen? And Klinger has the line about, I think they broke one of the commandments. they all march back. And this leads to this montage. It's not actually, let me take that back. It's not a montage. It's just kind of Gene Reynolds pulls the camera back and just lets all the business happen. And he doesn't move the camera. And we just see Jeeps going by. But it leads to one of my favorite little moments of the show. And it's, again, what you talked about at the top of the show. The beginning of the change of Margaret. I love that Margaret is on the back of the horse with Colonel Potter, and she's got her arms around him, and he is directing. He's telling, he's got his hands, he's go over there, you go there. And it's such a warm moment. She's smiling. Yeah. It's such a great, like, she is with her father figure. She is
with
this
family.
Man. Yeah. She is with this man that she inherently trusts. And it goes by in just a couple of seconds, but boy, I just love it because again, it feel like it's showing us that these two have already bonded and that Frank Burns, as you say, as we know, is on the way out in every conceivable way. But I don't know. I love it. I love that they threw that in, that she's there and is sort of like just watching him be in command.
It's that. It's also just seeing Pot again, as I was saying before about that, it would be a totally different episode if it were written under Henry.
Yep.
And you see him in command as a military commander, not just as a great doctor or a father figure. you go here, you go there. He's got the horse. He's doing this. He's looking very, very official. And it's like he knows what he needs to do. And even when, just another quick little note on Margaret too, is that one of the things that they always showed about Margaret is that her struggle to maintain her military discipline against her femininity, which, you know, now is not quite the issue, but then was a very big part of the character. And when she gets up on the horse, the way she kicks her foot back, like in mm-hmm. a girlish way,
yep.
to get help. Margaret doesn't need help getting onto that horse, but there's still that one little note, and Hawkeye duly obliges yep. her like a gentleman. She gets on it, and then you're right. She's so relieved that her family is home and that she feels protected again, but she's also, you know, as we've seen, incredibly brave. And just getting to see, like I said, this is one of my favorite Potter episodes, because you really get to see him, you know, as the leader of the camp, and not just this, you know, the father figure or the you know, the one telling the funny stories or whatever. It's like, this is a commander, and it gives you a new respect for him and for the show itself as a military unit.
Yeah, it's marvelous. It's a great way to end this sort of the final act. And then, of course, there's the button where the show ends where it began, which is yes. Hawkeye and BJ back in their beach chairs, yep. watching the digging of the new latrine. And they talk about that it's been contaminated. Why is that? Well, don't you remember? Frank fell into it. And the two of them have a nice chuckle. And that's the end of the episode. And again, yeah. this is a masterful, yeah. big episode. Again, as I said, a lot of hour-long sitcom shows don't really work, but like Welcome to Korea, this is like a little war movie, and it's just, not that I never thought it was funny, I always thought it was funny, but rewatching it again for the purposes of this review, I was like, man, this is a gangbuster show. Yeah, it is so funny. All the characters get something good to do. There's some great dramatic moments. It's just really a really stellar way to kick off the new season.
Yeah, you know, when you asked me if I wanted to do this, because I had asked for a different episode this season that I wanted to talk about, and then you were like, "Look, I got someone else." I'm like, "Okay, whatever." And you're like, "But how about the premiere?" And I'm like, "Oh hell yeah! I mean, I could talk about that one." And then I didn't, you know, even before I rewatched it last night, I was like, "Oh yeah, there's a lot to talk about in that episode. Yeah. That's a good one." And it's just, again, think about it this way: what a great way to start a season. You know, the show was power packed and popular, and it was at its most muscular, and it's just great. And also, like you say about the button, it's just a nice way of showing that life goes on. Mm-hmm. You know, that there, you know, yes, all the just with all that craziness, but of course, eventually everything comes full circle and they're back to doing what they were, with the understanding that there's going to be more chaos ahead, but now is the time that they can actually breathe again.
Yep.
And it's also a reminder of that's also the nature of MASH too, that they would go long stretches where they were basically living in the middle of nowhere with nothing to do.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I said, it's a really, really great way to start the season. So Dan, we went through a lot of great jokes across this episode. Ooh. I saved one for my favorite line or joke. Do you have a particular favorite joke?
I don't. Other than I think that the most comedic payoff of the show, though, is the Klinger dress scene. I think that all of that, I think, is great. And I think it's when Potter turns to Klinger and says, "Son, that was one of the most bravest things that I've ever seen," you know, or however he delivers that I know how hard that was for you. I know that was, you know, because when you think of that, you know, the bravest thing, you think about some kid falling on a grenade or something like that. But no, it's Klinger giving up his dresses, which was just as much a sacrifice as anything else. And Potter's, you know, humorous acknowledgement of that, I just thought was a great line.
And so the whole sequence is terrific and just very, very funny. Great physical comedy, great, you know, character bits. My favorite joke, again, which I purposely left out when we were doing the summation, is when is when Hawkeye goes to Rosie's bar and she's surprised and she goes, "Dr. Stud." And his response is, "With two D's. Two D's. I would love to be called Dr. Stud. That would just be great. I just love that he just handles that so beautifully with two D's. So I thought that again, and a show that made me laugh from beginning and that one, I just laughed so hard at that. So, well, Dan, thank you once again for coming back and kicking off the season with me. I really appreciate it. It's always fun talking to you. And so, why don't you tell people, not as if they don't know, where they can find you out on the internet?
13th Dimension, my website, which you yourself, of course, have contributed mightily to over the years. It's not a MASH website. It's a comic book website. But we've even found a way to get MASH and comic books after years in the laboratory.
Yep.
We've got a piece coming up that is going to be tied to this, where the MASH comic book connection. So make sure you check out that out on 13th Dimension. Plus, of course, if you're into comic books from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that's kind of our forte. So, you know, come pay us a visit, follow us on Facebook, on the Twitter. You can find us pretty easily.
Absolutely. I really had a blast writing that piece, and I'm excited to see what people thought about it. Because, yeah, we talked about it a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I had the hardest time kind of – when people see it, they'll understand what we're talking about. But, like,
right.
Had kind of coming up with the right ingredients, and then I finally did. And, and it was so much fun to write, to be able to sort of put together two of my favorite things all in one spot, comic books and MASH. So it was absolutely a blast to write. So, of course, everybody, thanks so much for listening. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter at MASH477Cast. You can find all the back episodes of the show on our website, FineWaterPodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast, and there you can unlock various awards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Daniel Ulrich, Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Britt Schramm, Mike Thomas, Michael Porter, and Joe Perino. Thanks so much for your support of MASHcast. I very much appreciate it. We'll be back next week, but until then, that is all.
Again. Don't give me that static, lady. We're here to establish MASH 4077. You get your concubines out of here.
Concubines?
Out, lady, now.
Business before war.
That's what makes America great.